then all nations concerned must come to a peaceful adjustment with their neighbors. When once such an adjustment starts, economic and military disarmament must be considered an important factor. There are today no less than 7 million men mobilized because of the immediate threat of war. Entire frontiers are closed. The economic life of countries have been regimented for the emergency. A highly integrated world economic system cannot stand such war economy without reducing the standards of living and driving nations to bankruptcy. The agenda today at the various commissions of the League of Nations covered such subjects as economic and financial questions, transit and health, intellectual cooperation, and traffic in social questions. I asked an important official here today whether, since only 4 days separated us from Black Saturday, do you think it is unrealistic for the nations to be discussing these technical questions? To which he replied, the alternative to military force, threats, ultimatums, and mobilization is intelligent planning to build a peaceful, healthy, and prosperous world civilization. Geneva represents the House of Planning. If the nations avoid war now, they must substitute intelligence. If they must have another war, it almost destroys civilization because another lesson is necessary. They must return to the precedents and practices established here. In conclusion, it would be surprising indeed if the long-distance reaction to the tension through which the world is passing would not be a revival of faith in collective security. Alliances and a balance of power and isolation have demonstrated themselves this week to be poor alternatives to the policy of world cooperation to prevent aggression. The next few days will be fateful for the ideals and principles of our world, possibly for our generation.
You have been listening to a talk direct from Geneva, Switzerland, by Mr. Clark M. Eichelberger, who is the director of the League of Nations Association. His talk coming to you as another part of Columbia's extensive coverage of the present European crisis. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WCCO with studios in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Columbia continues its extensive coverage of the European crisis by presenting to you again its news commentator, Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn.
Good afternoon, everybody. Let me begin by reading to you the latest bulletin that has come to us from London, England. It states this: Great Britain will join with France and Soviet Russia in a triple front against Germany if Adolf Hitler decides to attack Czechoslovakia. This is an official statement just issued by the British Foreign Office. The statement came out while Hitler was delivering the speech in Berlin. The Foreign Office statement declares that Mr. Chamberlain has been trying to find a peaceful solution to the Czech problem and that it is still possible to settle that problem through negotiations. But if, in spite of all Great Britain's efforts, Germany attacks Czechoslovakia, France will go to the aid of the Czechs, Russia will follow up France in accordance with the treaty, and Great Britain will also join in defending Czechoslovakia against invasion. The importance of that declaration is that it is the first time that we have had from London a straightforward, definite declaration from the Foreign Office that Britain has decided to join with France, with Russia, against Germany in case Germany attacks Czechoslovakia. Remember, however, that this statement has no relation to the Hitler speech. It was issued while the Hitler speech was going on, and the British Foreign Office is too careful and too slow-moving to have based a statement of this kind on anything that Hitler said. Moreover, since Hitler rarely prepares advance copy and relies almost entirely on extemporization, there probably was no official copy of his speech issued in Berlin before he spoke. Therefore, I feel that I am right in assuming that this declaration is merely the expression of the conclusions that were reached by the Franco-British conferences in the cabinet both yesterday and day before yesterday, and that Russia has been queried, has responded, has definitely indicated that she stands with France and with Britain. And the importance of this declaration is that it is official, that it comes at the time of crisis, and that it definitely confronts Germany with an unequivocal declaration at least 4 days before Germany will march into Czechoslovakia, that if she does so, that there will be war, and that in that war she faces not only Czechoslovakia, but also France, and also Russia, and also Britain. Moreover, the events of the last few days and hours have indicated to us that Poland is settling her problem with Czechoslovakia by way of negotiation, and it is to be assumed that Hungary will do the same thing. Hungary has been warned by Yugoslavia and Romania that if she moves against Czechoslovakia, that they will attack her. And since that time, there has been no word of any military movement in Hungary. This, then, is the lineup. France, Russia, Britain, Czechoslovakia, fighting against Germany. Germany relying, as Mr. Hitler has just told us, on Italy, but relying without any unequivocal public promise on the part of Benito Mussolini that he would stand with Hitler in a war under these conditions. And we know also that Yugoslavia and Romania, to say the least, are benevolently neutral. Therefore, the question is, what will Hitler do when he finally digests the new memorandum which came from England today and to which he probably did not refer in his address? It was difficult for me in listening to it and in translating it when he spoke of Mr. Chamberlain's proposal to know whether it was the one that he rejected and that he worked out his answer to in Godesberg, or whether it was a new proposal that he made in answer to the one which was delivered to him this morning. I am now inclined to believe, after studying his address and studying the circumstances, inclined to believe that he was not answering Chamberlain's latest proposal in what he said. He was discussing his own memorandum, but he did reiterate that that memorandum was his last word, and that unless the Czechs had evacuated the German Sudeten territory by October 1st, that he would move, that he would enter Czechoslovakia, that he would launch the war. And you heard his enthusiastic approval of the German army. You heard his statement that he felt very definitely that Germany has the strongest anti-aircraft force, the strongest anti-tank military equipment. You heard his prideful statements that he felt safe in reference to any war that might come, particularly when he saw or looked across the Alps and saw Germany and Italy marching, as he put it, in a single block. Now, he went on, however, in discussing the details of his memorandum to indicate how reasonable he thought that he had been. He said, "I've fixed a boundary. It's the boundary that I fixed from the beginning. All we want is the incorporation of the Germans. Now, I'm ready to make any reasonable adjustment." I was ready. And when Mr. Chamberlain came, and I am grateful to him for his efforts on behalf of peace, well, I proposed a German-Czech commission. Chamberlain proposed an international commission. And so I accepted and said yes. Now, during the vote, I am even willing to withdraw the German troops. I am willing to have an international commission supervise the plebiscites which are to come. But I am told now that the memorandum which I handed Mr. Chamberlain is a new situation. Where is the new situation? Yes, it's a new situation for Beamish, but otherwise there is nothing new in my proposals. I've always said what I've asked, and Beamish very well understood. We Germans have demanded that after 20 years, we must have an affirmative answer. And as I look across the Alps, I realize that there is a man on whom the German people can depend, a man whom they respect. Now, Beinisch and I are two different persons. The German people are unified with me, Hitler continued. It will regard my will as its will. We are holy. We are unified. We are determined. We are ready to stand against any danger. That is a summary of what Hitler said. But more important than what he said is what it means. Now, I see, as I study this speech and think it over, I see that Hitler has left himself a way out. After all, if he felt, as he must have felt and known, that the united might of Europe was standing against him, if he had really wanted to take Czechoslovakia by force and expected to do that, it seems to me that he would, before he made this address, have launched his troops and have endeavored to carry out what the Germans have been talking about for the last 5 years, the lightning thrust, which, in the opinion of German military leaders with whom I have talked, is the only way in which a modern war can be won in any way that means anything. Now, Adolf Hitler announces that he won't do anything until October 1st, and that he will move on October 1st. It seems to me he's giving his potential enemies a tremendous advantage in telling them, now get ready, I won't do anything for 4 days, and then on the 5th, I'll move. No, I honestly believe that Adolf Hitler, on the basis of the speech he made today, still feels that the peace of Europe can be saved. He feels that he has already made a great contribution with the concessions that he has made, and I think he is quite sincere in believing that he has been grievously wronged in connection with the German minority problem in Czechoslovakia. Of course, it is true that Czechoslovakia, under pressure from Britain and France, had agreed to surrender the Sudeten areas. Well, to me, it is inconceivable that having agreed to that surrender, there should not be some way, halfway perhaps, between what the French and the Czechs and the Britons are willing to concede and what Hitler asks. After all, as Hitler himself has said, it's just a question of method. It's just a question of how the plebiscite shall be held. It's just a question of how the German troops shall come into the area. And that other point, there was not a word in Hitler's speech about the Hungarians or the Poles that indicated that he intended to go to war in order to preserve their rights and to secure their liberation. Not a word to that effect. And that was the one problem of the two problems, one concerning the way the German troops should go in, the other, the way in which the other minorities of Czechoslovakia should be dealt with. Those were the two problems that were in the forefront of the difference between Chamberlain and Hitler, and Hitler's failure to insist that he is going to stand up for the Poles and that he is going to stand up for the Hungarians seems to me to provide an opportunity to solve that problem. Perhaps he has been advised that the Poles and the Czechs have already begun to work their problem out together. So, after all, when you look at the speech as a whole, while naturally it was belligerent, while it did emphasize Germany's unity, while it expressed the hope for joint action with Germany and Italy marching together, it seems to me that on the basis of it, we have no immediate prospect of war, and we still have 4 days left for negotiation. Good afternoon.
And so the analysis of Chancellor Hitler's address by H.V. Kaltenborn, CBS commentator, concludes this epoch-making broadcast, which was a part of Columbia's extensive coverage of the European crisis.